You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Business of Practice podcast, where we focus on the business and human sides of equine veterinary medicine. In this episode, we're going to talk with Dr. Jim Zeliff about the emergence of the issue of mid-level practitioners. I'm your host, Dr. Amy Grice, business consultant and former equine practice owner. The Business of Practice podcast is brought to you in 2025 by Care Credit. Dr. Jim Zeliff grew up in northern New Hampshire, where he enjoyed trail riding and skiing. He attended Purdue University with a major in biochemistry, after which he earned his DVM in 1988. After an internship at Belmont Racetrack in New York, he founded Allegheny Equine in Murrysville, Pennsylvania. More recently, in 2019, Dr. Zeliff earned his MBA. He is an active member of the AAEP and has served a term on the board of directors, was co-chair of the Compensation Subcommittee of the AAEP Commission for Equine Veterinary Sustainability, and currently serves as the AAEP representative to the AVMA Legislative Advisory Council. During his free time, Dr. Zeliff enjoys traveling, skiing, and spending time with his wife and their son and two daughters. Welcome, Dr. Zeliff.
Hi, Amy.
In the wake of Colorado voters passing a ballot initiative, Proposition 129, last November, that created the position of a veterinary professional associate, also known as a mid-level practitioner, many veterinarians are really concerned. This person, after training and certification, would be licensed to practice veterinary medicine under the supervision of a licensed veterinarian. I'm eager to learn more about the idea, how the idea of a mid-level practitioner emerged, and what's already happened, and what is coming down the pike. Can you help us with understanding?
I'll give it a shot. And certainly, if you have any questions, Amy, we can go wherever you want to with this. But to start with, so Colorado was the first case, and even though it was the end of 2024 election that this came on, they've been attempting for years to get this done in the state of Colorado. It was originally brought through the state legislature, where the state Senate and House was tried to get this passed, and it did not happen. There was enough push against it that the Colorado legislature wasn't going to pass this. An interesting thing about the state of Colorado, and there are a few other states that have this type of policy, is that if an event goes through a ballot amendment like we did, a ballot initiative, and passes, then once the people have spoken, they automatically have to open up and change the Veterinary Practice Act in order to make this law. Most other states, it's truly a legislative issue at the state level, where even if the people say they want it, it still has to be crafted and put together by the state House and Senate, and these things can either happen or not happen depending on where that goes. And there's a lot of influence veterinarians can have at that level because of their individual representatives. But in Colorado, and there's a couple other Western states that are set up this way, that once this ballot initiative passed, it had to happen. And so that's where we are now. As far as maybe why it started to back up a little bit, I think during COVID, there was a very strong feeling that we had a gross undersupply of veterinarians, and that there was a lot of reasoning behind that. Clearly, we know that we have an undersupply of equine veterinarians in certain areas, as we know from our initiatives and things that we've done at the AAP level. But We feel, meaning we now as the AVMA and the AAP together, that the best way to handle this is not to generate this in the middle profession that both pushes I think the biggest negative thing is it pushes down our the role of the certified veterinary technician. It jumps right in there. And also the big thing that they're still working out in Colorado is, what are we talking about as far as supervision? And it's very clearly worded. They get to practice veterinary medicine under the direct supervision of a veterinarian. The folks that really wanted to see this happen in the state of Colorado, they had a very sympathetic governor that thought this was a great idea. He's a very animal welfare-oriented person and was convinced that this is a real problem, that animals are suffering because there's not enough access to veterinary care. We do know that a lot of the money to get this going did come from some big corporations that are involved in corporate veterinary medicine. And these are large employers of veterinarians. There are two specific groups. The All Pets Deserve Vet Care and the Dumb Friends League are very large, very well-funded organizations in the state of Colorado that were really pushing to see this happen. So this was incredibly well organized. They went through many different ways to get it, and they finally, when the ballot amendment came up, this seemed to be the way they were going to make it happen. Obviously, they did. When this first started, though, they had about a 75% favorable poll from the people of Colorado, but the AVMA got involved with AAP and the Colorado Veterinary Medical Association to educate people on what we're really talking about here, the level of training and what are they really going to see at the level of your general practice that most of the voters are going to. And really, we made a lot of progress, and that 75% got knocked down to about 52%. Still enough to pass, but it was close. The other things now that we're sorting out, or they're sorting out in Colorado, is, like I said, what is supervision? What does insurance look like? Exactly how's this training going to go? How's this certification? Because the AVMA is not going to put together and administer a test like the NAVLE. So Colorado's going to have to do this on their own. And they're planning on it. The State Board of Veterinary Medicine is tackling this, but it's quite a deal over there in Colorado. The thing is, though, is this was just the first one. These are national organizations that want to see this happen, and there's some rumblings down in Florida. That's the only other state that the AVMA has been called in to help with. They're there. They're kind of have to wait for the local state VMA to call them in and ask for help. And it's the same way with where we stand with the AAP is Colorado. We have made ourselves available to help, but as far as getting these last couple questions answered in a way that's more favorable to veterinary medicine, but they're doing pretty well on their own right now. So the AAP is ready and able and good to go when other states call. But Colorado is kind of a done deal, and they're just sort of dotting I's and crossing the T's.
The Business of Practice podcast is brought to you by CareCredit. CareCredit keeps equine veterinarians at the heart of care by providing horse owners with simple, budget-friendly financing options. By helping to bridge the gap between costs and care, CareCredit supports healthy financial relationships between veterinarians and their clients. Clients have a flexible way to pay over time for all types of care, and practices get paid in 2 business days. It's a payment experience everyone can feel good about.
Yeah, one of the calls that I got was from the Montana VMA, living in Montana, And they have taken a very proactive approach, formed a committee, and before anything is even necessarily happening here, is that something that you would recommend
Absolutely.
For other states?
So my most of my organized veterinary medicine work has been with the AVMA and the AAP, but I did get involved with Pennsylvania, my home state, as I started to learn about this. And Pennsylvania did not have a clearly stated position statement.
Oh, dear.
And we don't want it. Let's make this clear. Pennsylvania does. The veterinarians do not want a mid-level practitioner to come to Pennsylvania, but there's some action going on. There are some state representatives that have been contacted. One of our universities doesn't think it's a bad idea because they're there to teach, and this is something else they can teach. So nothing's organized, nothing's pushing, but there's rumblings. So the first thing the veterinarians need to do is make it clear where they stand. And I know that Ashley Morgan is our new person for advocacy at the AAP, is organizing this and trying to get a point person for us in each state that can make sure that this is clear. Because I think when a governor gets approached, and the governor is the one that's kind of driving the ship on these things, and says, what do you think? Who are they going to go to, right? They're going to go to the dean of the vet school, and they're going to go to say, what do the veterinarians think? What's the state VMA think? And I think it's really important at this stage that every state think this through and make their intentions clear and make it something that is very easily accessible. And a position statement that's been agreed upon by the board of your VMA goes a long way.
So individual equine practitioners are not usually very involved in their VMAs. Some of them are, but many of them aren't, because they are a minority. I mean, face it, we're a very small part of the overall private practice groups of veterinarians in the United States. So, you know, would you recommend that the practitioners that are listening to us today, like, reach out to their VMAs and try to get involved? And, you know, it's so much easier to do it ahead of time.
I got to tell you, when I made a phone call, you know, I literally went, and I'm as guilty as everybody else, right? The CE, and not to toot the AEP's horns, but that's where I get my CE, is the AEP convention. And I don't go to the Pennsylvania VMA meeting, and I should. And the biggest thing that your VMA does for an equine practitioner is this kind of advocacy. And your dues help pay for this. You know, your state most likely has a political lobbyist at the state level that is supported by your group, and you need to support them. Now, I will tell you, though, when I made a phone call, that I went to the website and got a veterinarian's name and Googled him and called him up and said, hey, Jim, which is his name. And I said, what can I do? And he's like, come on down. We'll get you on some meetings.
I've got a job for you
because the equine vet practitioners, for the most part. But I got to say one thing, though, is that probably the most active group of veterinarians, equine veterinarians in their state VMA, is Colorado. That group has been really active. There's multiple veterinarians that have been the president of the Colorado VMA, and so I don't want to. It's rare to have that level of equine influence and advocacy there, because what will happen, honestly, is that the decisions will be made by small animal veterinarians for us if we're not there.
Right.
And it is critical. And it's not that hard, right? You can just get on the committee and go to a couple meetings, but make yourself known. Your where you stand on these things is really important. Other things we can do, though, like you're saying, well, I really don't want to see this happen. What can I do as an individual AAP member veterinarian? Most likely, you've got a member of your legislature that you've come across somewhere in your, you know, the state House of Representatives. There's a lot of folks generally on that. And if you just ask around or Google them and find out if they are. And honestly, these people are, it's most of the time it's a part-time job. Call them up and ask them if they want to meet you for a cup of coffee and let them know how we feel and just get it in there and let them know where we stand. If you're fortunate enough to have a relationship with your governor or the governor's staff, that's huge. As well as somebody that's on your state board of veterinary medicine. Now they're not quite their responsibilities, because they are sort of a regulatory body for your state as well. Mm-hmm. They're not going to want to be quite as chummy and to sit and let you know all of where the state stands. But to have them listen and let them know where we stand is really important, because those folks are appointed by the governor, the state board of veterinary
medicine. Right. And they're supposed to be looking out for the public's well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In Colorado, they had some shifting around of the people that were on the board to make sure everybody was agreeing with this. So,
uh-huh.
So that can happen, right?
And, what do you think will happen with practitioners who are supposed to be, once these, you know, mid-level practitioners are around, they're mm-hmm. supposed to be sort of in charge or responsible for their work, liable for their work.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had any discussion? Do you have any idea? Like, can people just say, uh-uh, not doing it?
So the model that this was put together for, right, is a big small animal clinic, probably more like a humane society type deal, that's doing high volume, low cost care, okay? And that way you're all in a room together and working in the same area.
Right.
And so a veterinarian can get people up to speed on things. I'm not saying I agree, but
right.
this is
but
the
they
way
could.
The model that they think, right? That you're all in the same building and,
mm-hmm.
and someone's there to sort of be walking around looking over everybody's shoulders, because all these people are going to be practicing under their license, right? It's a big
mm-hmm.
deal. And so you would, hopefully this veterinarian, whoever this would be, who's working for a big corporation with all these mid-level practitioners, or we'll call them VFP panels in Colorado, underneath them, will be being very careful to make sure that good care is being administered. But you flip that on the equine end. I mean, how much good does it really help us if we can't put somebody on a truck and send them out without
right.
a veterinarian standing next to them? And what is that different from what we have our techs do now?
Right.
You know,
right.
You can have, your techs can go vaccinate for you while you're doing lameness exams, right? So there's mm-hmm. there's a lot of things, if we utilize our technicians, I want to make sure I get to that, because that's a big part of all this. Is how do we increase utilization and address this from that direction? One important thing to throw out there, which is very different from our human medicine counterparts, is that federal law states that only graduate veterinarians can prescribe medication. So you have your nurse practitioner that you can go to and they'll listen to your chest and supply, you know, prescribe you antibiotics. Non-veterinary medicine cannot happen. And that's not a state-by-state thing. That's a federal government thing. So that's another piece now, right? So this veterinarian
mm-hmm.
that we're seeing everybody else is now, the meds have to be scripted off of their license as well. So interesting thing, though, was when I started to talk to people in Pennsylvania, and I had an opportunity to have a great visit with the dean of the vet school, as well as the Secretary of Agriculture. And they're like, okay, we get where the veterinarians come from. Secretary of Agriculture wants to support the veterinarians of our state. But their point is, we have an undersupply of veterinary care what can we do to make this work? And so what we are pushing with here, and our recommendation to the AEP board has been to let's really dig into how we can use the technicians that we have to aid the veterinarians to do their job more efficiently and get rid of this perceived shortage. And I say perceived shortage because there's a lot of places that it's not shortage. And I know there's so many people that can't find vets, and I get it, right? That there is a shortage, especially in certain areas of equine veterinarians. But there's the other thing, right? We've got 13 new schools ready to start cranking out diplomas. And that's another reason in my mind where we want to be careful not to overdo it, overreact here. But that's, I think everybody's in agreement with that, right? Like, this isn't something
right.
I want to do.
And honestly, I think it's going to be incumbent upon pet owners, and I'm thinking mostly companion animal kind of pet owners at this point, to be aware of the qualifications of the person that's going to be working on their animal and advocating for themselves if they are someone who wants a higher level, like I would, want a higher level of, you know, pets are like family members now. In the AVMA owner, you know, demographic survey, it's over 90% are considered family members, not even, you know, pets are. So, you know, I think it'll be important for people to have more education about it so they understand who's in the room with them.
Absolutely. And what kind of training that person's had.
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you one thing that the dean here at Penn shared with me is that we are not really in a position to critique how professional educators have put together their program, right? Like, we can say 2 years isn't enough, but let's not dig into the details of what CSU has put together and make our our judgment on the decisions they've made on how they're going to train people, right? They're professional. But what was very successful in Colorado was explaining what kind of education your veterinarian has versus this 2 year program here, right? And,
right.
and there's a big difference, and make it clear.
Most of it, which was online.
Yeah.
So that is fabulous. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners that they should know about this situation?
Yeah, so sort of the important thing to because most of us don't want to see this happen, right? So what can you do as an individual? And getting involved at the state level is really important. But also to understand this has to be a coordinated effort, that you've got two big groups. So the AVMA is much, they're just as strong, if not stronger, against this than the AAP is. And, you know, anytime, anything we have, they have 10 times, right? And that's personnel, money, training of their people, the government relations division of the AVMA has got bricks and mortar facility in Washington, D.C., and a staff of professional lobbyists who get things done. And then they have a whole nother state arm that handles that as well. And your state VMA most likely is hiring their lobbyists as well. So for us to jump in and say, because we thought this when at the convention this year, when we put together this task force, we're going to go fix this, right? We're equine veterinarians. We're gonna make this better. And we found out that there's really good people doing this. We need to kind of support them, but not get in their way. And, and so these things, you know, there's an article that we put out in Eve that kind of walks you through the areas that you can help. And Ashley Morgan, our new person I alluded to earlier, is doing a great job putting it all this together. And her position was the very similar state advocacy position with the AVMA. So she is really working hard on making sure that all of us are doing, if we want to help, there's a place for us. Reach out and kind of get plugged into the right spot, because this is a big deal. There are people that would love to see this in the 49 other states as soon as possible. And
And that Eve issue is April of
correct.
2025, and
Yeah.
it was in the early onset, like maybe Roman numeral page 5 or something.
Yeah, in the beginning.
So you guys can find that.
Yes. And it kind of goes over what this task force has done and what our next steps are.
Cool.
But it's interesting to go through this, and we certainly don't think it's the best thing for veterinary medicine. But I think the biggest thing is look at your practice act and know and see what are you doing that you could have a tech do to help you, and give these technicians the opportunity to do more and develop some skills. You're going to have to work with them. It's going to take some time. Because we all know that the veterinary technician schools, for the most part, are better at training small animal techs than they are at training equine techs. But once they pass the test and are certified, there's a lot of things they can do and really make our life a lot easier.
Yeah, we should probably have a shout out to the AEVT, where some people they'll get a certificate and then go on and get their actual veterinary technician degree, or the opposite, because there's so many opportunities within that program to really learn some of the equine specific things. It's a pretty terrific group.
If the people see what my experience has been in our state, if they see that we're not just complaining, but we're coming up with a solution, they'll be a lot more likely to hold off on doing anything drastic and letting it play its course. And so, state by state, Montana or wherever it is that someone's going to be, those are important things to look at. Cool.
Thank you so much for visiting with
Yeah.
us today, Dr. Zeleff.
And thank you for the opportunity, Amy. This is great.
Absolutely. And thank you all for listening to the Business of Practice podcast. And a big thanks to our sponsor, Care Credit. And to all my listeners out there, be brave, embrace change.